All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And that only makes sense, okay? That only makes sense. The Michael Slate Show, I got to be the host, Michael Slate. All right, and the day that you hear somebody with a different voice or a different name, you know you're being taken for a ride, okay? Start calling everybody now. All right, anyway, enough of the jocularity. How's that? That's my new word for today, jocularity. There you go, Kiki. Okay, all right. We have a packed show for you today. Right? At the back end of the show, we are going to be talking with actors Ernestine Phillips and Max Lawrence from Alice Childers's Trouble in Mind, a play that's now out at Theatricum Botanicum, and it's going to be a great conversation because that was just a great play. I really enjoyed it and really highly encourage people to go to it. Before that, we will be talking with Jeffrey Robinson, ACLU Deputy Legal Director and Director of the Trone Center for Justice and Equality, on Trump's July 28th speech to an audience of cops. Okay, which he called police state authoritarianism distilled to its essence. That's what Jeffrey Robinson has called it. So we're going to be looking forward to talking with Jeffrey Robinson. And actually, my first segment, if you've been at all awake, you've seen what's been going on in relation to recently. It's just the resurgence, the push out by the fascists all over the country, laws being passed, things being restricted. Back a little while ago, Heather McDonald, who wrote a very, very terrible fascistic book. It was a book called The War on Cops, and it was upholding the police. And she came to Claremont McKenna College out just a little bit east of Los Angeles, and she was scheduled to speak there. And the students organized a protest that basically shut her down. And then in mid-July, when students were all off campus, all at home, the people who rule Claremont McKenna decided that they would wreak their vengeance upon the students. A number of students were, basically, they were forbidden to graduate. They were put on a year's notice that they had to wait a year to graduate, which meant that if they had their diplomas and they were ready to go to grad school, medical school, jobs, they wouldn't be able to do so. And they'd have to explain, why was there this big year-long gap in your education and your ability to do anything? And they also punished a number of other students for daring to stand up and shutting down Heather McDonald, making it impossible for her to actually spread her poison throughout the campus. And this is one of many things. There was the students at Middlebury College actually shut down Charles Murray, another well-known reactionary racist dog, who wrote a book that was all about, it was called The Bell Curve, and it was all about saying that black people just weren't that intelligent. And it was a matter of, you know, just the way that their genetics falls out, all right? And he was also shut down at Middlebury. And in the wake of all this, there's been a huge assault on what they're calling freedom of speech on campuses. And they're saying that things have to be much more restricted, that we can't allow these students to come in and just shut these things down, that we're in the interest of actually really giving everybody their fair chance to say what they believe. We're going to go after students and telling them that they are not allowed to disrupt like this. And I was really, really just really drawn to this story because it actually says a lot about what's going on in the society. And I knew that my guest for today, Sansara Taylor, he's one of the founders of Refused Fascism, and she writes for Revolution Newspaper. And I knew that Sansara would really be anxious to talk about this. Sansara, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. I'm very glad to be with you. And you're right. I think this is so important to talk about, and I'm eager to do so.
Well, let's get into the first thing I wanted, just in terms of digging into the stuff that I was just talking about. What's your take on what happened to the students at Claremont?
Well, I want to start by stating that it is absolutely right, and it is righteous, and we'll talk about why this is, for students to stand up, to shut down speakers like Heather McDonald and Charles Murray, to drive them off campus, and to drive the fascists out of power that they're connected to, both ideologically and programmatically, and in some cases organizationally, the whole Trump-Pence fascist regime. And if that seems like a leap of a connection, I will argue it out and I will make the connection. But it is really important that we start with the students at Claremont College were heroic and did what needs to be done. We are living in a time when black people are killed and Latino people are killed by police with impunity over and over and over again. It's caught on video camera. The police are not even indicted in almost any cases. When they are indicted, they're almost never convicted. And where it is a common experience of black people throughout the society, as well as Latinos, to be harassed and brutalized, stopped and frisked, illegally searched, pulled over disproportionately for driving while black. walking while Black, attending college campus while Black, and to be harassed, to be brutalized, to be wrongfully arrested, to be tased, to be murdered. And it is a widespread epidemic of police brutality and terror. And Heather McDonald is not just some person coming and expressing controversial views. She is an intellectual hitman who is justifying and rationalizing this. She works for the Manhattan Institute, and she has published ream after ream, and finally a book called The War on Cops, which turns reality on its head and proclaims that there's some movement that is terrorizing the police, when in fact it's the police who are terrorizing Black people in particular, but not only Black people. And she uses a lot of statistics, very, very narrowly selected, to try to change the topic and to further criminalize Black people and to demonize and criminalize those who are standing up and demanding justice at a very time when now a regime has come to power that not only is it the ongoing slow genocide of police murder and non-indictment and non-conviction, but where Trump just came out and said openly, I know your second guest will talk about this, and I'm glad you're doing that, openly said to the police in a speech recently, Donald Trump in Long Island, to speaking to law enforcement, don't be too nice when you arrest these, quote, thugs. Don't be too nice. Rough them up. Brutalize them. Essentially do what was done to Freddie Gray. Throw them roughly into the back of the paddy wagon. And that's how Freddie Gray died. And it's a particular that fits that description, but it's a living concentration of a whole epidemic that Trump is trying to accelerate very consciously. And so Heather McDonald came to justify this and argue for this. And the students stood up and blocked the entrances to the building. They protested. They organized. They expressed their right to free speech and their responsibility and their righteous responsibility to stand up and say, no, this whole racist and fascist program that is being argued for must not be tolerated. It must be shut down. It must be driven out. And here, before I go any further, I want to say something about the First Amendment and free speech, which is the rallying cry these days of these fascists. Oh, our free speech was suppressed. Oh, poor Heather McDonald. Oh, poor Ann Coulter. Oh, poor Milo Yiannopoulos. Oh, these poor Charles Murray, these poor fascists and racists who get up there and are challenged. The First Amendment says that Congress shall pass no law to restrict people's freedom of religion and freedom of expression and speech. It does not say that students cannot exercise their right to speech to shut down and disrupt very, very damaging and harmful messages that are being put forward. And students they're not passing laws. They didn't pass a law that said Heather McDonald can't speak. They didn't try to imprison her for speaking. They don't have any state power to do that. What they did is they organized themselves. And the students are sitting in a position of not having institutional backing and power. And the voices and the opinions that they are putting forward by challenging this white supremacist pro-law enforcement brutality message that Heather McDonald is putting forward, they're going up against established authority. Heather McDonald is coming in and she's first of all got huge institutional backing, huge funding, and she's putting forward ideas that dovetail and reinforce the very policies that are being promoted by the state. She's got tremendous backing. The students are the ones who don't have that kind of backing, and they are relatively powerless, and they use their bodies and their voices to courageously stand up against power, state-backed power, and racist and ideologically poisonous messages that were being put out. And it is their right to free speech that is being denied, that's being suppressed. And now students were suspended. Students had their degrees revoked. And this is both a great crime against those individual students, but it's sending a message to all students and young people and people more broadly in society that you cannot stand up and challenge the right of the quote-unquote right of fascists to spew their poison. This turns the First Amendment on its head, and it's immoral on top of that. Because one last thing, I know it's a complex argument, so I wanted to make one more point in this opening round on this, is that if you really cared about free speech, and I challenge this to the administration at Claremont McKenna College, if you really cared about free speech, and I challenge this to all those fascists who love in the alt-right and the Fox Newses and the Trump himself who have given voice to this idea that right-wing and fascists on campus are the victims, and they're suppressed. If you really cared about free speech, the biggest enemy to free speech has been Donald Trump and his administration. And this reveals the hypocrisy, because you don't hear this huge rallying cry against Trump, you know, tweeting out that he wants to strip citizen rights from flag burners, which is a form of free speech that actually is going up against entrenched authority. You don't hear the same howl from all these forces saying, you know, complaining when Donald Trump sent his spokespeople out to threaten the media, saying we want to open up the libel laws and sue these journalists who are publishing stories we don't like. You don't hear this rallying cry of free speech when Donald Trump is assaulting and threatening the legal protection and threatening to unleash the state against people who challenge his authority. You only hear it in this false victimization, self-victimization that's portrayed by these Nazis who are coming to the campuses and saying, oh, poor us, somebody disrupted our ability to spew our poison, which is being implemented by the state. It's a complete distortion.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm speaking today with Sansara Taylor, writer for RevCom.us, Revolution Newspaper, and co-initiator of Refused Fascism. And we're talking about the fascists and white supremacists invading U.S. campuses and the outrageous punishment of students at Claremont McKenna College in Southern California for taking a stand against the fascists and shutting down a talk by Heather McDonald. Following up on that a little bit, you know, it's interesting. The students at Claremont actually, they issued a statement where they said that the way fascism is masked as free speech is not any normal exercise of constitutional rights or power. This is a critically important concept that needs to be examined. The issue is not free speech, it is fascism. What would you say to that?
They're right. It absolutely is. We're living in a country right now where there's a fascist regime in power. And that's not an insult or an exaggeration. They are ripping up what have been, one, they are demonizing whole peoples, the white nationalism, the ethnic cleansing of banning immigrants, of banning Muslims, of rounding up and deporting people, of enforcing English-only priorities for immigrants. The stalking horse that the problem now from the Justice Department, the so-called Justice Department, that the problem on campuses is discrimination against white students. I mean, this is part of a fascist white supremacist targeting of those who don't fit the white national identity that this regime wants to reinforce violently. But it's also a fascism because it's ripping up the democratic protections, traditional democratic rights and protections that have existed. And you see that actually happening with these students, where forms of mass and, yes, disruptive protest, that's the hallmark of how any fundamental change has been won in this country. That was the Freedom Rides, let us remind ourselves, were against the law. They were violating unjust laws. They were against the law. They were disruptive. People put their bodies on the line. The lunch counter sit-ins, the protests during the Vietnam War, the burning of the draft cards, that was illegal. These were people who were putting their lives and their futures on the line and disrupting the normalcy. Campus takeovers that were part of the struggles of the 1960s against the Vietnam War that took over buildings. These were all against research and development of horrific weapons of mass destruction against the Vietnamese people. These were things that went on campuses and off campuses that have been at the core of how those who don't hold state power, who are either the victims of the terror that's brought down by that state or who see those crimes as unjust and don't have state power themselves and have put themselves on the line to challenge that. This is what is being criminalized. And you see it in the case of the Claremont students who are very severely reprimanded for doing what was a nonviolent, mass, very righteous protest, an exercise of their own free speech. And yet they're being criminalized in the name of protecting free speech. So I agree with their statement. This is not about freedom of speech. This is about fascism. This is about fascism, and not every idea deserves a protected platform. Those ideas that go up against the entrenched authorities, and especially genocidal and white supremacist and fascist ideas and power, those people who are challenging that authority need special protection from the state. But to bring the state down on them in the name of protecting the very fascists who are wielding the power of the state is the biggest farce. And too many liberals are falling for it, and too many people are distancing themselves and allowing this chill to take place. and it's very high stakes. These students should be defended. They should be upheld. The administration should be condemned for punishing them. And more students and academics and people off campus, too, have to have the backs of the student protesters and have to stand up and recognize that the chilling out of the campuses of intellectual discourse of the students and of professors, it's multifold. One, the Nazification of the campuses is a critical part of consolidating fascism in the country as a whole, you know, and that was true in Nazi Germany, and it's true today, and there are people in the White House who recognize this and have been working on this for decades, and that's what these punishments and laws that are being proposed and passed around the country to criminalize student protest are really about. And two, because the campuses, just on the first point, the campuses play a disproportionate role in the ideas that are allowed in society, so you have to clamp down there. And two, as we saw after the elections, the campuses and students were on the forefront of waves of protest, and righteously so, against the Trump-Pence regime. The night after the election, the Not My President protests that swept across the country, but especially on the campuses, and this is something that the fascists fear. And so they're criminalizing these students. And if we don't want to accept a fascist America, we have to take up this fight to defend the students' ability to stand up and protest. But we have to do it in the context of not only driving the fascists off of campus, but driving them out of power.
Mm-hmm. It's extremely important. You know, when you look at this and you think about this, there's, you know, I was just going to ask you about this thing of the ideas, because here's the thing. They oftentimes people will be, and the students are being assaulted with, you're not letting us have our free speech here. You're not letting us say what we need to say. We were letting you say what you need to say, but you're getting all, you know, out of whack, and you're causing a lot of trouble. And they make it seem like that this question of speech should be allowed. It's that in the abstract, it's just a question of what speech should be allowed in the abstract. It's not a matter of whether it makes the university look good or bad, nor is it the importance of the free marketplace of ideas. All these things, there are ideas that, which is what you were just saying, there are ideas that have been implemented and continue to be carried out that have meant tremendous suffering and death for humanity and shouldn't be protected. I mean, you think about the kinds of things, the kind of research that gets done in some of these places, the kind of thing that Heather McDonald was talking about, support the cops as they go and slaughter people wantonly in the streets, black and brown people in the streets. This is the kind of, this is the stuff that's never spoken to. And I think it's extremely important for people to actually understand that there is, that point you were just making is, it's not speech in the abstract, speech that actually means something and has an impact on society, and whether it's good or bad determines whether it should be supported or not.
Well, there's also, with that, there's a question which always gets obscured from the discussion of who holds state power and what interests are entrenched and given the backing of the state and the weight of tradition and of the social and cultural and political and economic functioning and structure of society. And so oftentimes it's said, well, if you want your right to speak as a protester, as somebody who doesn't like Trump, you have to most of all protect the speech you find to be most heinous and offensive. Well, I don't think that's true. I mean, what you most of all have to protect is those ideas that challenge that entrenched authority and power. For example, you know, Heather McDonald's ideas, they don't need protection. They don't need protection. You don't need special protection to argue, as she does in her book, that Eric Garner, that the police who choked him to death, as he said 9 times, I can't breathe, I can't breathe, and we all watched that video over and over. You don't need to be protected to say that the police should be given a green light to do that. The state already gave them a green light to do that. That's already happened. That's not an idea that's endangered. That's an idea that has authority behind it. And is, yes, has carried out murder, but two, it's promoted on the news channels all the time. It was promoted in the courtroom. It was promoted from the state, and now it's promoted from Jeff Sessions and Donald Trump, who are openly calling for police violence and to lift the consent decrees that have constrained even mildly some of the extra legal terror that the police have engaged in. So you don't need special protection for that. You do need special protection to be a student or a protester in Ferguson to stand up and say, no, we don't want to live this way. We will not accept this. And in fact, it is those students who have had their rights denied. And it is protesters who have been disproportionately arrested, charged, held. It's protesters more recently in D.C. during the inauguration who are facing 70 to 80 years in jail. They're facing more time for standing up and raising their voice against the policies and the program of the fascists in power, or the protesters in Ferguson, many of whom did go to jail, face more time than the police who carried out a murder ever did. And so I just want to, you know, I want to say to everybody that it's not speech that is most offensive that most needs protection. It's the speech that is most challenging to unjust authority that needs protection. And right now it's the students. Right now it's those who protest. Right now it's those who dare to defy the fascist regime that is moving quickly to consolidate. And the people who are putting forward the ideas of the state, that doesn't need a special protection. And I'm not saying they should be censored. I'm not saying there should be a law passed that denies them the ability to put those ideas forward. First of all, the idea is absurd. The very people who would pass the law are the people who have those ideas. But I'm saying that when the students stand up and shut that down, they're not infringing upon free speech rights because they're not passing a law. They're exercising free speech rights. And I just think this question, it's always put like we're in some even playing field and everything is just ideas. No, we live under a dictatorship of a class that holds power and is wielding that power in a certain way, and it damages certain people, black people, women, people around the world who are never counted as full human beings, and others. And when people stand up against that, that is what needs protection. And that is what's righteous, and that is how change has come. And everybody who has an ounce, you know, the impulse to say everybody should have the right to speak, I get it, but you're not really going to protect the rights of those who are most vulnerable to being suppressed unless you stand with these students, unless you stand with those who are being wrongly criminalized and penalized for exercising courageously free speech against really heinous, poisonous, damaging ideas and policy and authority.
Sansara, I have one more question. It's going to have to be quick. And I do want to have you back to talk about, you know, you're a communist. And I want to have you come back and talk about a social society and beyond that and what that what freedom of speech would look like, how it would be posed in those societies. But we can't do that now. I foolhardily thought, oh, well, I'll throw that question in. I realized, oh, we'd be here for another half an hour on this one. But we can't really do that now. But I wanted to ask you right now, where do things stand? What's at stake in all this right now? The universities, and there was a point, I think I read it in revcom.us, that said the universities must become zones of resistance and the importance of standing with students at Claremont McKenna, Middlebury, and anywhere else where people refuse to give a foothold to Nazis. It's extremely important, and it has a lot to do with where this world goes today. Let's talk about that as the final note.
Okay, so I'm with you on all of what you just said, and I thought, too, let's talk about what kind of world we could have and how a socialist society would handle protections of speech and why we need a different state power. And I agree with you, we don't have time for that today, but I will say that Bob Avakian authored a constitution for the new socialist republic in North America, which is available at revcom.us, that really takes into account the need to protect the ability of everybody to hear ideas put forward by their most ardent advocates, but in a context where you are digging up and overcoming all forms of oppression and exploitation. And it's a very advanced, it's a revolutionary document. And so people should check that out. Right now, I think we are getting ready for campus to start again. I would tell everybody that the campus, the fight to defend and uphold the students and to, yes, drive these fascists off of campus and to have the moral certitude and the understand and the certitude that it's right. And it's not just, well, you know, it's right and it's in keeping with opening up discourse. And frankly, disruptive protest often can open up new ideas and new substantive discourse in a way that doesn't happen if you just sit quietly and are polite. New ideas get put forward. The challenge those McKenna students brought forward, that this is not about free speech, this is about fascism. People are debating that now because they put themselves on the line in a disruptive way, and it was right. So that can open up debate. I think that people need to have the backing of these students. They should complain concretely to McKenna College. If they're alum, they should write letters and not donate and make a big stink. But also we have to take this up in the context of the mission of Refuse Fascism, which is refusefascism.org, which says, look, the nightmare must end. The whole Trump-Pence regime must go. And in the name of humanity, we must refuse to accept a fascist America. We must get organized to drive these fascists out of power concretely by going outside of normal political channels, going into the streets, doing the disruptive acts, doing mass political sustained resistance. And there's a program of struggle. There are plans that are going to be announced with that at this point, because I know we're out of time. I'll just say, you know, everybody should go to, in addition to revcom.us, the website, which is the voice of the Revolutionary Communist Party. People should go as well to refusefascism.org, which is a broader effort that unites communists and many, many others to refuse to accept a fascist America and to move in a unified way from all our different perspectives to act in a way that drives these fascists from power before 2018, before 2020, before it's too late. So I know that's a lot packed in at the end, but it's an invitation, and I'm sure we'll talk more soon.
We will definitely talk more soon, all right, because I really have a lot of questions for you on this. So, Sansara, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Michael.
Okay, take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Sansara Taylor, who is a writer for Revolution Newspaper, and she is also one of the initiators of Refuse Fascism. We're going to take a quick break and be right back with Jeffrey Robinson, so stay tuned.
Fit for rhyme, BS fit to spit. The hate produced, swung up in a noose. Most them history pages come in all stages, colors, genders, and ages.
Devil.
Black, brown, yellow, red, but white. Supremacy, tendency, and currency. Estrogen, robbing my oxygen. Still dissing skin, inform my next of kin.
Get in the back of the car.
What?
Let's go.
Crazy.
There's actually a lot more to that song than meets the ear right now, all right? It's No Sympathy from Chuck D and Public Enemy, all right? So we're going to cut that off now and play it again fully for you sometime in the future. Right now, I'm very pleased to welcome to the show Jeffrey Robinson from the ACLU. And Jeffrey, I found out about Jeffrey. I was reading an article on the basically on Trump's big rallying, his little Trumpian version of the Nuremberg rally. You know, he was there just whipping up his cop friends and all this other stuff and basically, you know, just hitting hard at the people and talking about the police need to be more unleashed to carry out their civic duties. And Jeff Robinson said some stuff that was really, really just grabbed my attention and I really wanted to talk to him. And here he is. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Sure. Well, let's jump on to this, man. You said that Trump's talk to police officers. This was actually the title of an article on your website, I think. It said Trump's talk to police officers was police state authoritarianism distilled to its essence. Yes, but now tell us why.
Well, I think many people look at our president and the things that he says, and they say, oh, he's speaking off the cuff, or, oh, he's just... I think his administration is even saying now that some of the things he said during this meeting a week ago Friday with police officers, they say he was just joking. But I think we have seen enough now to know that this man is not joking. This man is as serious as a heart attack, and when he talks about these things, it's important to listen to what he's saying. So in his speech on July 28th, he literally talked about police officers arresting people and essentially banging their heads into patrol cars as they're being put in the patrol car. And he said, you know, I said you can take the hand away, okay? Meaning take the hand away that's protecting the person's head. Here's the thing that I'm just asking people to think about. The kind of behavior he's talking about, roughing up a suspect when that person is arrested, is exactly what killed Freddie Gray. And you don't joke about circumstances where someone's life has been taken unless you see that person as less than human, as less than someone to be empathetic with, and completely unimportant. So when the president made this comment about police using force that is basically both illegal and unconstitutional, it's not a joke. Not when we have people in black and brown communities who are dying from this very kind of conduct that he's talking about. And I will say that one of the most frightening things about this presentation is that, you know, I'm not blaming every police officer that was there, but there were a large number of police officers who were laughing and applauding as he said this. And I think that speaks to the culture of policing in America when folks feel like, yeah, let's just get a little payback on the street. And oops, if it turns out that the person was innocent, well, tough. oops, if it turns out that this makes encounters between police and people in the community more dangerous, well, that's tough. This is the kind of America that Donald Trump sees, and I think it's extremely dangerous.
Now, he also said that, you know, he made this promise to repeal what he classifies as anti-police laws. And in fact, there's anti-police laws don't exist, really. So when let's talk about that.
This is one of the things that I wanted to write about, is that I think we have to remember this is a man who has said all kinds of things that are absolutely blatantly false, and then he just moves on. He doesn't care if he's accurate or not. And this is a man who said, and he was apparently correct, that if he killed someone on Fifth Avenue, his supporters wouldn't care. And so what he has done here in his speech to the police is talking about laws that are stacked against the police and they've been totally made to protect the criminal. And this is a quote. "These are laws stacked against you. We're changing those laws. No such laws exist anywhere in America. No such laws have been passed in the last 20 years anywhere in America." The Guardian newspaper reported that in 2015, there were over 1,100 people killed by police in America. There were 18 prosecutions. I didn't say convictions. I said prosecutions. So ask the families of Terrence Crutcher and Philando Castile if the laws are stacked against the cops, because we all saw those videos. The officer in Oklahoma essentially said, "Terrence Crutcher made me nervous, so I killed him." And the law, as written, protects police officers like nothing you have ever seen in America. So Donald Trump is essentially creating laws that don't exist and then saying, "I'm going to repeal those laws." And this is what he puts forward as support for the police or support for law enforcement. It is a complete and total fiction that has no substance at all.
Mm-hmm. This is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Jeffrey Robinson, ACLU Deputy Legal Director and Director of the Trone Center for Justice and Equality. And we're discussing his piece, "Donald Trump's Talk to Police Officers Was Police State Authoritarianism Distilled to Its Essence." Let's talk about one more thing, and I want to get, then I'll come back to that. But, you know, there's an element of what Trump is talking about in terms of screw the courts. Even given that the role the courts play, I mean, courts, and especially, you know, you're looking at what Sessions is arguing for bringing into being and all this other stuff, the courts are actually becoming more like sort of the entryway onto the cattle cars that are going to take you off to prison and who knows what. But there's this whole thing about that seems to be coming up more and more, speaking to Trump's social base, that vigilantism is actually the rule, that they need to take up vigilantism. And that seems to me what he's actually arguing, what he's promoting. And it's a way of building up these like sort of these fascistic stormtroopers in places all over the country. I mean, there is an element of, you know, I know people who were at a demonstration in New York City just a few weeks ago who were, and there was a big fascist demonstration and the cops had set up a fence supposedly mm-hmm. keeping them in. And then there was an anti-fascist demonstration right across the street and they had set up a fence there. And it was just like incredible because the fascists would have people coming out and attacking people and, you know, trying to meant something, and it was just very, very heavy when you look at this and you think about this thing of the rule of vigilantism, which is actually, it is a hallmark of a fascistic regime.
I think one of the most revealing points about the issue that you've just raised is this. Every single time that he has been asked, what is his response to crime in America? Now, first of all, I'm not talking about the mythical skyrocketing crime rate that he and Jeff Sessions talk about that doesn't exist. So I'm not talking about that because there is no such crime rate. I'm simply talking about the response to crime, which is always going to be an issue that people should be concerned about in America or anywhere else. He has one solution to that and one solution only: more stop and frisk. And let's be clear. When I say stop and frisk, I'm not talking about the circumstances where a police officer is driving down the street, they see a man standing next to a car with a broken window, and the guy has a crowbar in his hand, and they stop and say, "Excuse me, sir, I want to know what you're doing." No person in America is going to fault a police officer for doing that. I'm talking about stop and frisk where 75 to 90% of the people who are being stopped have done nothing and are doing nothing. And the concept that you can end crime in a neighborhood by stopping and harassing innocent people should make no sense to any intelligent thinking human being. And yet this is the only answer that he has for how we should deal with crime in America. And I think both he and his attorney general are stuck in, and I shouldn't say stuck as if it's somehow against their will. They just either don't have the intellect or the courage to think beyond what I call one-dimensional criminal justice. Find as many people as you can who are violating the law, lock them up for as long as possible, and then wash your hands and walk away and say, I've done my job. What people don't understand is that 90% of the people we send to prison are coming back. And if I want a president and an attorney general who are actually going to talk about the safety of the community, if they're actually concerned about that, then they should be just as concerned with what happens as they're putting someone into prison as what happens when someone, when those doors open and someone is coming out. And yet when you cut services in prison, when you cut educational programs, when you enforce and encourage restrictions on people coming out of prison, then you are essentially making the community a less safe, a less productive, and a less welcoming place to live in. So this man's criminal justice policy is both one-dimensional and retrograde. He has nothing new to offer, and that's why vigilanteism or violence against suspects sounds really good, because it makes us feel good. That guy did something wrong and he got his head cracked open. And if that's the way you think, that seems to be a great way to deal with the criminal justice system. And for me, it's sad and pathetic.
I have one more question for you. You know, we're going to have you back, too, on a more regular basis.
To.
That'd
no,
be great.
Thank you.
Sure. One more question for you, though. You know, there is this point of, did you see the movie Detroit?
Yes.
Okay. So that whole scene sort of speaks to what we're talking about now in a certain sense, where these cops come in and they torture people, they murder people, and they walk away free. You think about that even in those times, and you think about that now, and the question of really what Trump, it seems to me, is really calling for is this unleashing of a fascist terror. I mean, even the fact that, think about this, this is one of the things that really got me, is he talks about, you know, MS-13. He talks about as if all Latinos are actually part of, and it implies, it doesn't say it,
right,
but, you know, part of MS-13. He talks about them as they're animals, or they're less than human. And he does this whole thing, his characterization of gang members and others all the way down the line. It's a dehumanization that reminded me the kind of dehumanization that brought into being or allowed the thing like what was going on in Detroit where these cops tortured and murdered people at will. And it also reminded me too of an even bigger thing in terms of what's at stake here. The Nazis' dehumanization of Jews and other people they saw as unclean and enemies of the state.
I think there are a couple of things to what you're saying. Number one, none of this is new under Donald Trump. It's not like the police violence in black and brown communities in America just happened. People are always talking about, since Ferguson, what has happened? And I just laugh, because the only thing new in America about police violence are cell phones and videotape. My community, I'm a black lawyer, a black man here in America, and my community has been dealing with violence by law enforcement against us for my entire life, for my parents' entire life, and for their parents' entire life. The only thing that's new is that it's on videotape, and America is having to have what I call a naked lunch moment with police violence in America. And Naked Lunch, the book by William Burroughs, was defined by Burroughs when he was asked, what does that title mean? He said, it's that frozen moment when everyone has to look at what's really on the end of their fork. And what we are having to do in America right now, because of all of the videos, I call them snuff films, of people getting killed by police, we are having to look at what has been an epidemic in this country for quite some time. And the other thing that's not new is the concept of dehumanization. if you want to make it easier to kill someone, if you want to make it easier to give someone a 30, 40, 50-year prison term and have folks just forget about them, then dehumanize them. Call them animals. Call them less than worthy. Make them the other. And throughout history, what we as human beings have done to those that we see as the other is staggering. So this is why I'm saying this man is much more than a joke. And what he is saying is not funny.
Mm-hmm, definitely. All right. Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us today, Jeff.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah. And what's your website so people can go and check it out?
ACLU.org.
Okay. And they'll find your name there and they can go and see your
Absolutely.
Blogs and stuff. Right. Okay, Jeff.
Absolutely.
And we'll be in touch again in the future. All right.
Thank you very
much. Sure. Take care now, man.
Appreciate it.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with attorney Jeffrey Robinson from the ACLU. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with two members of the cast of a great play that's being done out at the Theatricum Botanicum. It's called Trouble in Mind, so stay tuned. Welcome back. That was Public Image Limited, all right? As regular listeners to my show may know, I sometimes present interviews with actors, directors, or playwrights of plays that may not be performing in your area. That's the case with this next segment, a conversation with two of the actors, Ernestine Phillips and Max Lawrence, in a current production of Alice Childress's play Trouble in Mind. Now, Alice Childress was one of the giants of the theater, a playwright, actor, and author whose work spanned many decades and included a number of firsts. She was one of the first African-American women to have work produced on the New York stage. When Trouble in Mind, the play that we're going to talk about today, was produced in 1955, it won an Obie Award for the Best Off-Broadway Play, making Childress the first African-American woman to be awarded that honor. Yet the play didn't make it to Broadway because producers demanded changes that would have destroyed the play's power, and Childress refused to allow them. Childress left behind a body of work that includes the young adult novel, A Hero Ain't Nothing But a Sandwich. She created better roles for women and wrote works that dealt with the oppression of black people and the people at the bottom of society. Childress described her writing as trying to portray the have-nots in a have-society, saying, "My writing attempts to interpret the ordinary because they are not ordinary." Although Trouble in Mind was written and performed during the earliest years of the Civil Rights Movement, it contains lessons that are timely and relevant for the moment we are in the time of Trump and explicit and blatant white supremacy. So let's give a listen to the interview. I'm really pleased to be welcoming to the show my next guest. You know, I went to Theatricum Botanicum, always at least one play. At least one play every year always just grabs me, and I got to go see it, and it's remarkable. And I went to see the play called Trouble in Mind, and it's a play by Alice Childress, who is a playwright who is not alive anymore, and who through most of her career, even though she was very prolific, but she also had to fight for every inch of ground that she got. And she wrote a play called Trouble in Mind, and it is being put on by Theatricum Botanicum, and it was an incredibly from beginning to end, I just sat there and I didn't want it to end, okay? I kept thinking, no, we've got to go further. And joining us today to talk about this is Max Lawrence.
Good morning.
Yeah, good morning to you, man. Get a little closer to the mic. There you go. And you play, so tell people who you play in the...
Yes, in Trouble in Mind, I play John Nevins. This is a play about a group of actors, and in the middle of the 50s, they're putting on this show that has some very strong racial implications. A group of black actors and white actors, and I play one of the black actors, a young black actor. This is his first Broadway show, and boy, is he about to get an education in some things.
And one of the people that gives you that education is sitting across the table from me. I'm telling you, it's remarkable because I have to say something here. We did this. I had you in a little while ago. About what, 2 years ago now? Something like that? Maybe a little bit?
Yes. Yes, it was 2 years ago.
To Kill a Mockingbird.
To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yes, 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 yes. And it was, go ahead.
Yeah, I was Calpurnia in that. I had a great time playing her.
Mm-hmm. But the thing is it was also, you came in here and we talked about that play and we talked about it again after the show was over.
Yes.
And it was just an incredibly important thing. And then to see you step up in this role now where you play, tell people who you play in this.
I'm Ernestine Phillips and I play Willetta. Now, Willetta she's been around a long time, but basically musical theater. She's done a lot of musical theater, but she gets this opportunity at the twilight of her life, I guess you could say. She's been around that long.
I want you to look at who you're talking to, okay?
Oh,
talk about twilight of life, okay?
To do a dramatic part, and it is Broadway. She has made it to Broadway. And has made a career doing a lot of stereotype parts, and as a lot of actors have, and especially during that time. But this time she gets a chance to do Broadway, and it's not like she hasn't read the script. Does it even really matter? It's pretty much the same thing she's always done, and she's bit her tongue and done it.
And actually, in a way, I mean, I have to say, and Ernestine, I have to tell you. Ernestine Phillips is one of the best actresses I've seen, actually. I'm telling you.
My head has gotten real big.
It's allowed to, all right? Because it's actually, I mean, I know when I was sitting out there, and this was the opening night of it, and I was sitting out there, and everyone was waiting. They wanted to talk to you, but they also wanted to talk to Ernestine because you just, something in the what you brought in the character just, and it was true, the same thing with the part that you had in To Kill a Mockingbird, just really reached out to people, and I thought that was extremely important.
Well, I always say that my ancestors sort of always rise up to greet me. There's something, there is something about these women that you want to try to make them as truthful as you possibly can, as you know it. And as Max has heard me say, and any other young person, they hear me say, I always say, well, you know, I grew up in segregation and I'm still pissed about it. That you want to bring these women their truth to life. I have no problem playing them, but you really want to show what they went through, what my mother went through.
Let me ask you this, because and this will feed over to you too, Max.
Sure.
Because in this play, and Alice Childress is actually a remarkable writer.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Incredible.
One who never, 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 ever got the recognition that she deserved. And she did finally, like Britain, they produced this play, and it was a smash hit. In the U.S., they told her, could you ease it up a little bit, make it a little bit more friendly?
Right.
And she was like, yeah, get out of here.
Right. And, you know, and she tried, for 2 years, she tried to compromise. Mm-hmm. But no, they wanted more and more and more. And she says, absolutely not. You know, when this play was first produced, I think it was November 4th, 1955. Interesting enough, just less than a month later, Rosa Parks refused to get up off the bus. You know what I'm saying? All this stuff was happening. But when it was first produced off Broadway and it won the Obie Award, she played Willetta. Because she didn't trust anybody else with it. Mm-hmm. She directed and played the part. And I'm sure she was just incredible, doing it.
Now, let me ask you this. That's an important point. It leads right into what I was going to ask you, which is, look, you know, you're playing Willetta. And Willetta is actually, yes, it's true what you're saying. She comes and she's sort of, look, she's a little bit sort of been through this, been down those roads. I know what's going on. So I'm just going to sit back. I know what to say. I know how to talk to the director. It don't matter what I think. I'm just here to get paid. That's it. And Max, your character comes in. Starry-eyed and like, yes, and you know.
Very young, very naive at the start of all this promise, yes.
Right, and Willetta says, grow up, man.
Right, she doesn't, she schools him. It's her motherly instincts come out. It's a protectiveness. This is how you survive. Now, you're the new Negro, but don't be too new. because if you're too aggressive or too cocky, you're going to be out of a job. This is how you handle white folks. It's like the poem, We Wear the Mask, which is absolutely true. And this piece is, I'm talking about pulling the curtain back. This is right in your face.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let me ask Max, We Wear the Mask. Did you think about that when you were, when your character, because your character does come in, really set the theater world on fire, and then is forced to basically shuffle and smile and giggle.
It's the number of lessons that he has to go through over the course of this play was really fascinating. The thing that I drew the most inspiration from was in Ithaca, New York, in where I went to college, and in 2008, going into 2009, that was my senior year, and seeing Barack Obama had just been elected, and then in January 2009 was the inauguration, and this sense from so many of my classmates that we have made it. As America, we have made it. We have entered this new era of post-racial society. And I looked at that, I reflected on that experience, because in the eyes of John, he's seeing Rosa Parks. He's seeing the Montgomery bus boycotts. They mention Little Rock, the Little Rock Nine, you know, so the iterations that this play has gone through, they've included that play, they've included, or that point in history, they've included Dr. King. He is walking into New York, coming from Virginia, and into New York with this idea of we made it. We are at an era where my generation is going to fix the things that the generation previous couldn't. And then, you know, his first interaction is with Willetta from this former generation, and she's saying, no, this is the formula. And he has to take that with, you know, naively, with a grain of salt, because, you know, like all young folks, they don't know how it is, and they don't know where we're headed. And, you know, this new generation and the friendship that he forms with the young white actress of the company, you know, this is the future to which we're headed. And then he gets this awakening, the way I imagine many of my classmates in Ithaca, hopefully by now, have gotten this awakening that the future that we thought we were marching towards, that we thought we were ushering in, is not here yet. Very much not so.
Mm-hmm. And not even, Willetta is not the only one who warns him. The other black characters do too. Millie tells him, stay away from her. This is not going to work for you. This, you know, we're going to be out there marching in your defense or something, trying to raise your bell if you keep getting close to this white girl.
And he says, "What did I do? I'm being nice.
Right.
And even, I didn't do anything."
Even the older black gentleman that's played by Gerald Rivers, and Millie's played by Constance Lopez, and then there's Judy
Durkin
as right. And we have a whole a dynamite cast, you know, with Mark Lewis and Chris Jones and everybody there, warns him about this. So it's not just Willetta telling him that this is the social climate. I know you, once again, you're the new Negro, but you ain't that new. You can still be lynched.
And in fact, actually, there's a very powerful, we won't go into it because I don't want to take anything away from people, but there's a very powerful description of a lynching that was viewed by one of the cast members that was just, I mean,
it
had the entire audience in tears and angry, you know, but then see to look at that, and I have to tell people that there is, without giving much away, I have to tell people that Ernestine, your character actually has the most influence on basically everybody else in the cast, and people judge themselves going up against you, and there's a point where you begin to question things.
Yes.
And that is an extremely important point because it concentrates all that's going on at the time, but also all that's happened in the past. And you're reexamining your entire life. And Max, you're sitting there and your character is like, wait a minute, damn it, man, you told me to do that. And I bought into it. And what do you know? And
right.
So, but there's like this thing at the end, going towards the end, where things change. And it's one of the most both painful to watch things, but also one of the most liberating in terms of seeing this play. And because you have a play within a play where the black people in this cast are actually, and most of the cast has bought into the whole scene.
Oh, yeah.
But then there's a questioning that happens that happens with you first, Ernestine, with your character, and Max, then with yours.
Yep.
And it really, I mean, it is a remarkable thing to watch because it really has a lot to do with even what's going on today in terms of, yeah, black people got it made, man.
Right.
They can do this, they can do that. And then you think about Trump telling the cops, as we were just saying, Trump telling the cops to, you know, you want to smash their head in, you want to, you know, do this, do that. There's all this stuff.
And brutalize people because of the color of their skin.
Right, right.
And this thing that's happening in Missouri, where the NAACP has a travel ban. I mean, this is the first that for the whole state that it is
it's a warning
for people of color not to go through Missouri, not to live in Missouri, and et cetera. It is the most, I think, the horrific thing that can happen to this country. And if it takes off in that state and goes to others, I mean,
I think they're getting ready to declare it for the entire country.
Wow. Can you believe that? I mean,
yeah, I can believe it. I can, actually.
It is, wow, what is one step forward and a whole bunch of steps back?
But that's the thing, and that's the thing that I want to encourage people to see this play.
But let's talk about Ellen Geer for a minute.
Say it real fast.
An incredible director, fearless, respects her actors like no other, likes it right in your face, telling the truth.
All right, people are throwing things at me on the other side of the screen.
Oh, they are. We're done? Oh, my God.
Okay, let me just say this.
Okay.
Ernestine Phillips, Max Lawrence, just an incredible, incredible play. You guys are two members of the cast. The whole cast was remarkable. And I think this is a play that people need to see. So don't miss it, all right?
Please, please.
Trouble in Mind, Trouble in Mind, Alice Childress.
And it's a perfect time to have Trouble in Mind, all right? All right. All right, that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank my guests, Sansara Taylor, Jeffrey Robinson, Ernestine Phillips, and Max Lawrence. The website that Sansara mentioned is refusefascism.org, and the special announcement that she mentioned is now on the website under End This Nightmare. I'd also like to thank all the people who worked on the show, my assistant producer Henry Carson, my production assistant Jeff Pryor, and engineer Kiana Williams, as well as each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with Decisions from Outer National. Talk to you again next week.